Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Crime and Science Radio with your host DP Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called Inside the Los Angeles Regional Crime Lab, an interview with Dean Giolamis. And now, here are your hosts of the show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Crime and Science Radio. We're especially pleased today to have Dean Giolamis, who has over 23 years' experience in forensic science and is now the head of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department Scientific Services Bureau, which is the name they give for their he's their crime laboratory director. So before that, at the Orange County Sheriff's Department lab, and it sort of divided his time between the two. He's just recently had an important appointment that we'll talk about a little later to the newly formed National Commission on Forensic Science. So, Dean, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you, Jan and Doug. Thank you for having me on today.
Yeah, Dean. We're great to have you here. We're really looking forward to this. As you know, a lot of our listeners are crime writers, and they always want to know what's going on out there in the real world of crime. So, you as director, how did you get to this place in your life? What brought you into the forensic world, and you know, what's your background, and what made you interested in pursuing this as a career?
Well, actually, my interest started when I was going to college. I went to school thinking I would be a pre-med student going to UC Irvine, and I had a chemistry professor named Dr. Vince Gwynn, who, interestingly enough, worked on the Kennedy assassination. He had a technique using a nuclear reactor called neutron activation analysis, which was basically a mouthful of words that looked at the chemistries of lead and bullets. And he would go off on these tangents during his talk, always kind of bringing in forensic science as one unique way of using science in a modern world, and it kind of struck an interest with me. So I approached him about maybe auditing one of his classes, and strangely enough, he told me no. And what he encouraged me to do, though, was to get an internship in a real crime lab if I was very interested. So with a little bit of persistence, I was able to get an opportunity at the Orange County Sheriff's Crime Lab. And pretty much as a result of that experience, it sealed my fate in realizing this is definitely something I want to do. And I ended up pursuing my college education and tailored my career very heavily around that experience. As far as my background goes, education-wise, I was a chemistry and biology double major in college. Some might call it an overachiever, but it was something that because I went pre-med, I figured I'd get a biology degree, but I didn't really have to do that much more to earn the chemistry degree, and I'm really glad I did it because it has really paid off for me in my field. And then later went on to get a master's degree in forensic science from Cal State Los Angeles, which interestingly enough, now our building for the L.A. Sheriff's Crime Lab, our main facility and headquarters, is now located.
So let's talk a little bit about that. The Hertzberg-Davis Forensic Science Center is really unique in a number of ways, not the least being that it's shared space. There are two major and really huge law enforcement agencies that house crime labs there, the LAPD and your organization, the LA Sheriff's Department. And the placement of a lab on a university campus, I mean, that's like three major organizations, the county, the city, and the state, having to work together. And I think the state DOJ also has the training there. I don't know if that's still going on. But can you talk a little bit about how that lab formed and how those organizations all work together within it?
Certainly. You know, I think looking back in history for us, our needs assessment started in 1998. And just to give all the listeners a perspective on time frame, it wasn't until 2007 that we actually moved in the facility. So it was a little over 9 years in the making. It was really the brainchild of my predecessor, Barry Fisher, the recently retired crime lab director of L.A. County Sheriff, who had a goal of combining the educational component of a criminalistics program with a working crime lab. And as a result of a number of years of study by grand juries and input from policymakers about the possibility of a regional crime lab, it was brought forward. There was a ballot initiative originally, which unfortunately failed within L.A. County to help fund the laboratory and the facility. And ultimately, it was Sheriff Lee Baca who was successful in convincing then-Governor Gray Davis to find some state funding, allowing both the Sheriff's Department and the Police Department, along with its key players at the state level, the California Department of Justice Crime Laboratory, which is called the Bureau of Forensic Services, along with the Criminal Justice Program at Cal State Los Angeles. And I think many listeners might wonder how in the world could a monolithic beast like all those different entities get along, and it's surprisingly easy to do. One of the great things that was set up in the facility was a joint powers authority, which has very specific requirements. For example, the leadership of all the partners are required to meet on a monthly basis to discuss any issues or collaboration that we do. And I think that not only encourages the working relationship we have, but I think strengthens it literally every month that we meet. And as you might imagine, building a large facility is very, very costly. Building a laboratory is even much costlier than a large facility goes, because of the infrastructure requirements. And I think all of the work that has been put into it has turned this into a really amazing collaboration that allows not only some space sharing and technological collaboration between the sheriffs and the police department, but the integration of the university component, the teaching aspects, and what California Department of Justice brings as far as its training to Southern California forensic scientists has been nothing short of amazing.
It is an amazing facility, and it's probably the closest thing to the things you see on television that you'll see, because it's a very modern, very big facility, and it's really impressive. I was also interested to hear that you were a chemistry and biology in college. Yeah, I went through the pre-med route, too, and went on into medical school, of course, but I was a chemistry major and a biology minor, so I know what that's all about. Crime labs, you know, are of all different ilks, and they have different budgets and different capabilities and whatnot, and obviously your lab, the labs there that are housed at Cal State are impressive. What are the things that you can do, what the spectrum of type of things you can do there, particularly anything that you do that's special that maybe the traditional crime lab would not be involved in?
Wow. You know, a lot of the work that we do is, you know, in the non-exciting traditional world, you know, rather straightforward. I mean, you know, most people look at the television shows, you know, that bring some sense of excitement in what we do, but the reality is the bread and butter of our work is predominantly in the area of chemical abuse. So, you know, things like solid drug testing or toxicology or blood alcohol, that accounts for well over 50% of our actual caseload. for the LA Sheriff's Department, our component within that Hertzberg-Davis Forensic Science Center is we went in with the concept that that was going to be our major crimes hub. So a lot of the high-volume work that we do in areas like drug testing or the other controlled substance areas are regionalized work, because that facility is only one of 10 facilities that L.A. County Sheriff has for its forensic services. But in that facility, you know, some very interesting work being done with DNA, the idea of looking at, you know, molecular level identification of crime participants, firearms, the idea of being able to link firearms components, things like bullets and casings, to a particular firearm, or maybe even crime sprees using databases. We do our latent fingerprint development there. We're rather fortunate in that we have a particular instrument in which there's only four that I understand that exist in the world, two in the United States, and we have one here at the Sheriff's Crime Lab. It's called a vacuum metal deposition chamber. Believe it or not, it actually uses gold. It vaporizes gold to look for fingerprints, but the amazing thing about that device is you can find fingerprints on wet or soiled items. Now, most items don't come to the crime lab wet, but in a situation where, let's say, victims were put into some type of plastic container or plastic bags, the decomposition of the human body is such that those oils never really go away. So that chamber can be used for recovering fingerprints off of material that has the, you know, decomposition oils that, you know, would never dry out, so to speak. Not like a bloodstain would on a garment. We have trace evidence, and that's a plethora of and host of different types of areas, ranging from shoe prints and tire tracks to homeland security-like issues with arson and explosive evidence, to microscopic things like hairs and fibers, paint and soil samples, and the like. And then we also have our question documents area, which deals with the examination of written material, both electronic or handwritten, to determine whether or not an individual or an item was the source of that that writing. We don't do what some term as graphology. We can't tell you, for example, whether it's a male or female or whether they have, you know, social issues. It's really more about the science behind the mechanical movement, the kinesthetics of the hand, and how it works with that particular individual. And although check writing, most people, you know, in times past would understand that's a big caseload, not anymore. Believe it or not, we still get quite a few ransom notes. We get a lot of bank robbery notes that still come in, and we also do work in counterfeit material, for example, you know, counterfeit money. There's a trend right now where people will take bills. They'll use a specific method that, unfortunately, I can't disclose on this particular interview, but essentially remove all of the printing off of a bill, so they have the actual, you know, U.S. Department of Treasury paper, and they'll use a technique to reprint them. So people are turning $5 bills into $100 bills and literally making money out of it. Typically the job of the Secret Service, but in small amounts, they generally don't have time to work on those cases. So we've been trained to do that, and so that's an aspect that we've been working as well.
Yeah, some of the things that you mentioned, of course, I think people see some of them on forensic science shows, but we're aware there's a big gap between the realities that U.S. public crime labs face and the perceptions of them that people have from watching shows. Can you talk some of the things that you wish the public knew and understood about forensic science and forensic science labs?
Well, yeah, we don't hire former strippers and gamblers. I guess that's a good place to start. We don't drive Hummers, much to the disappointment of many, and we usually don't wear Gucci at crime scenes. But You know, the television shows, I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. I have to say, the television shows have been both a boom and a bust for us as far as the field goes. I think it's been wonderful in the sense that it's given notoriety to what we do and an appreciation for, I think, what we do. But I also think at the same time it sets up some false expectations in people's minds. We have a lot of folks who are interested in what we do in the field of forensic science. By way of example, I just had 10 openings for a forensic identification specialist, which is our kind of entry-level crime scene and fingerprint examiner position. I had 10 openings, and I had over 530 applicants for those 10 positions. So you can imagine the competitiveness that comes along. Many of them get weeded out because their perception and their understanding of this field is based on what they see on major network television. And although many of the technologies that are used on those shows are, you know, based on real technologies, they sometimes, mislead the public in what we can do. And I think in some arenas, it affects what we do. We're asked to do more and more with less and less on a regular basis. I think there's expectations from investigators, from prosecutors, from judges and juries on the kinds of things that we can say. And I think in some cases, juries get frustrated that we can't say more, almost as if they don't believe that, you know, that's the limitation of the science because their understanding is something different. And I think the biggest misconception that these shows produce is that, you know, we can solve a crime in 40 minutes without commercials.
Exactly.
And it just is not quite that fast. I usually joke with people that if you take every minute and turn it into a month, that could become the reality on a major complex homicide. You know, it may take a couple of years for the full investigation and the trial to actually occur. TV shows you that in just a very short time.
I think there's also some mix-up between what a detective does and what a forensic scientist does.
Yeah, thanks
in
to
a
the
lot
CSI
of
shows.
I completely agree. You know, we don't carry guns. Most forensic scientists across this country, although there are some exceptions, are what are termed non-sworn personnel. We're non-peace officers. We're typically scientists by training or have some forensic science background, and we're not cops, so to speak, on the street. You know, we don't carry guns. We don't make arrests. We don't interview suspects. We will encounter suspects, particularly if it comes to sample collection. You know, we may have to take swabs or samples from a suspect in a particular case, but we're not the ones carrying on the discussion and doing the interrogation like sometimes TV portrays.
Yeah, I think I even saw a show once where they treated an injured guy in an accident. yeah, besides carrying guns and doing interrogations and all that. Obviously, this has been called the CSI effect, and it's affected, you know, obviously you at your work and law enforcement and jurors and judges and attorneys, and everybody's kind of been affected by, I guess the law is a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, and you see all this stuff and think, you know, wow, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? Well, where's this? I can't tell you how many times in the Scott Peterson case I heard, what about the DNA? You know, of course, the answer is, so what? They live together.
Right.
I get asked a lot that about, you know, the CSI thing, how real is it? And I always say, well, it's got no basis in reality, really. The science that they do on these shows, from the ones I've seen, I'm not a big watcher of it but for that very reason. It drives me crazy. But the science, they usually get pretty right. It's just they make things that are rare, sophisticated, extremely uncommon, and unlikely, make them seem like, well, this happens every day.
Right,
And that's not life. Well, you're the director there, in case you didn't know that. and so... Tell us, what does a director do? I mean, what are your responsibilities? You know, what's your day-to-day thing? What exactly do you do? And what are the biggest challenges you face in herding the cats at the lab?
Well, I think, you know, some folks listening might think that being a lab director is just an amazing, glorified you know, glorious position to be in, but it's really an administrative paperwork, paper pusher position. You know, my biggest hazard is getting paper cuts, not encountering, you know, suspects or, you know, bombs at a crime scene like shows might portray. But in all seriousness, I think the responsibility of any laboratory director, much like any, let's say, CEO or corporate executive, is, you know, you're responsible for the personnel, the fiscal management of what goes on in the laboratory, and there's obviously a lot of responsibility that comes with that. But I would say that the very unique challenge that crime lab directors have are issues related to quality. You know, the field of forensic science is such that we're producers of information. And we don't just provide information, but we actually produce it. If you were to think about it from a, let's say, an economic model standpoint, you know, we take degraded, contaminated, insulted material, we have to analyze it, and we have to turn it into what's effectively perfect information that's going to be used to determine the life or liberty of someone at the other end of the line. And that could be on the side of prosecution, in the sense that we connect an individual to a, you know, particular crime or series of crimes, and they're going to be held accountable to it. Or it could be on the other end of the spectrum, where the results we find help exonerate someone who has been maybe wrongly accused of having committed a crime. And so I think the responsibility that we bear, anybody bears working in forensic science, is large, but as a laboratory director, you know, the buck stops at your desk, and you're ultimately responsible for the quality of the work that goes on. So a big focus for me is not only the typical managerial and workplace issues, but it's dealing with the quality at every single level of operation, ranging from the folks who bring in and take in evidence in the evidence control unit to people who order supplies. Are they ordering the right supplies and the right version and model so we don't have a problem or contamination in the laboratory, to the technical work done by the forensic specialists and our criminalists in the laboratory. So I think there is a lot of weight to bear, and unfortunately today you might have seen or heard in recent times of, you know, these what I'll call flare-ups in laboratories across the country, and unfortunately for, you know, peers in my profession, the laboratory directors are held accountable, and oftentimes, you know, sometimes either let go or have issues, you know, with their career because of something terrible that's happened in their laboratory. So it is a great deal of responsibility to bear, and one that I don't take, nor should anyone take, lightly.
Well, to sort of look at one of the issues that I think people have been kind of aware of with labs recently, or they think they're with labs, it's actually usually with law enforcement. Not long ago, the Sheriff's Department notably cleared a huge backlog of sexual assault kits, and that wasn't actually a backlog of material submitted to your lab and waiting to be tested, but it was instead, and this is the case I think all over the country, that kits are amassed over time outside the lab and never get submitted to a lab for testing. And there was a lot of publicity about this. And can you talk about how the Sheriff's Department cleared that backlog and what the status is of that evidence and sort of what, if anything's changed, and how rapes are investigated and sexual assault kits are handled?
Sure. Well, to give a little history, back in 2008, there was a lot of attention being placed on the idea of sexual assault kits and their analysis. And historically, the Sheriff's Crime Lab has had difficulty in gaining really the necessary resources to have to do DNA testing on a wide variety of areas. So with limited resources, we are really forced to be put in a position where we have to, you know, we have to judge which cases we'll proceed on and which ones, you know, may have to take a back seat for the moment. In the case of the sexual assaults, we had, up until 2008, really ramped up our work. And, in fact, in November of 2008, we had about 25 sexual assault kits that you would call in our backlog. And our backlog for us means that, we've had it for 30 days or more and haven't tested it or reported on the results yet. So 25 wasn't an extraordinary number. However, with a great deal of attention brought by a number of advocate groups, the primary of which was the Human Rights Watch, that ended up issuing a report that caught the attention of the County Board of Supervisors. And with that came a directive for us to determine how many kits were untested that were being held within the Sheriff's Department. Now, these are kits that, for one reason or another, the investigators had determined that analysis was not needed. Some examples might be the victim recanted, or the victim wasn't willing to press charges, or they learned that it wasn't really an issue of consent. So in other words, it was a mutual relationship or intimate relationship between two, and the assault was really something that had not been determined, or the victim recanted on the fact that it was an assault. So these
Before we go on, I'm hearing the music that means we're coming up on the break, and I really want to talk more about this. So let's take a quick break and come back to this, because it's a really important subject, I know, to a lot of listeners. So we'll be back soon.
Yeah.
back to the break, everybody, again, of another episode of Crime and Science Radio with your host, E.P. Lyle and Jan Burke. Again, today's show is called Inside the Los Angeles Regional Crime Lab, an interview with Dean Giolamis. And now we return to the show with your host, E.P. Lyle and Jan Burke.
Welcome back, everyone. Today we're talking to Dean Giolamis, the head of the L.A. Sheriff's Department Crime Lab. And we were just talking about sexual assault kits and how, in this case, there were a number of cases where detectives had basically evaluated cases or for one reason or another decided that they would not submit the cases to the lab, and this resulted in a backlog, not really in the lab, because quite honestly, I don't know many people that would say 25 kits was much of a backlog. I mean, that's for 30 days, that's a pretty low number for a major lab. So these were kits that hadn't been submitted to you for one reason or another, basically a detective's decision in most cases for whatever reason.
And that's correct. And actually, when we did the inventory, we had about 5,000 kits in our freezers that had never been submitted. And effectively, there was a policy decision made jointly by the Board of Supervisors and by Sheriff Lee Baca. And the decision was that we were going to test those kits. And the future of sexual assault kit testing would be that if any kit were collected in L.A. County, regardless of the investigative need, those kits were to be tested, which is what we've been doing since that time frame. At the time, we didn't have the resources to do that many kits in a short period of time, so we actually engaged in some public-private partnerships with some forensic testing labs across the country, and we had five private laboratories assist us with conducting the testing. The reason why we still had to have some involvement and we couldn't outsource cases completely is because of some very specific rules about DNA databases. The tier of local, state, and national DNA databases, which is called CODIS, requires that a forensic laboratory who is accredited, predominantly a government laboratory, needs to review the data before it goes into those databases. So what we essentially did was we would do some initial screening work. We would send cases out for the complete screening and DNA testing, and then they would come back to us. We would do what's called a technical review prior to uploading them to the state and national databases. We had some very interesting results and results that I think are very different than what other jurisdictions are seeing across the country, which I think for us helps validate what we did, but also, you know, somewhat complicated things when people look to us as an example of, you know, what the outcomes would be.
So basically in the case of LASD is that like we've seen in some other places, such as Ohio, they're really getting a tremendous number of indictments out of this and essentially solving cases where clearly maybe the screening by the detectives in all these different jurisdictions across the state weren't leading to similar results, you're saying, to what you had happen in L.A.?
That's exactly right, Jan. What we're seeing in areas like New York and Illinois and Ohio are situations where kits that, for all intents and purposes, should have been submitted to the crime lab were not. And as a result of that, there are individuals who appear to have perpetrated crimes or even serial rapes in which they were never found until this testing began. In those states, what we found here in Los Angeles, and it's true for both the city and the Sheriff's Department, is that very few of our total cases ended up coming back to providing new convictions taking new perpetrators off the street. Between our two agencies, both LAPD and LA Sheriff, with over 10,000 cases that we analyzed between the two agencies, there were only four additional arrests that were made as a result of that. The number may seem low, perhaps to the public, but I think what listeners need to understand is that the triage system that was set up with the collaboration between investigators, the crime lab, and in some instances prosecutors was probably working, because we should have seen much, much higher numbers when we look at our data compared to other jurisdictions. You'd expect us to have, you know, hundreds of additional arrests and possible convictions, but that wasn't the case. And I think that's due to the fact that the evaluation and triage system that was set up was actually adequate to serve the needs of the community.
Well, along that line of question, I probably get asked about every 20 minutes by writers. Let's say you get a good crime scene sample and a good suspect sample, and it's brought in for DNA analysis and matching.
Mm-hmm.
What's the absolute, let's say it jumps to the front of the line and you're going to start working on it right then, what's the absolute minimum time that you can get a profile done and compared?
Good question. Setting all resource demands aside,
exactly,
having people work multiple shifts, I can have a result in about 36 hours.
Okay.
Wow.
That's pretty good. Well, let's say, and a lot of our listeners out there are probably fascinated by forensic science. I'm sure that that's one of the reasons they're listening in. What if somebody wanted to pursue a career in one aspect, you know, either DNA analysis or question documents or as a chemist or something? What if they don't, you know, if they live next to Cal State LA, they can go to school there and learn it, but most people don't. What do you suggest people do, and how would they approach a career in this? What would you suggest the path they follow?
Sure. Well, first and foremost is your basic education. Most positions across this country will require a natural science degree in order to qualify as a scientist within the laboratory, and that would be a chemistry or biology or physics degree by way of example, or even a specialized area like forensic science, because there are many forensic science programs that are coming up across this country. I will add a word of caution, though, for folks who engage in the forensic science degrees, because there's a lot of, I'll be frank, a lot of money to be made by universities by advertising a forensic program.
Right.
As you might imagine, some are better than others. What I recommend your listeners to do is to do their homework and find out a little bit about the tenure of the program, and most importantly, are they accredited by what's called FEPAC? It's the Forensic Education Proficiency and Accreditation Committee. And what they do is they go into universities to make sure that the teaching program that is being delivered in forensic science meets national standards for education within the field. And if you go to a FEPAC-accredited university, you're likely getting, you know, the higher-end education. Not to say that if it's not a FEPAC-accredited university, it won't matter or won't count, but if it's specifically a forensic science degree that is not from a FEPAC-accredited university, there is the possibility that it may be viewed as a second-tier education compared to degrees from other universities. Once you've pursued a degree, I think, as I mentioned earlier, that the field is so heavily impacted with applicants that, you know, for us in management, it's wonderful because we're picking the cream of the crop, the creme de la creme, you know, of scientists. Unfortunately, for those on the other end applying, that means that there's going to be some disappointment more often than not. What we're finding is that individuals are coming in with advanced degrees, way beyond what's even required in the minimum requirements for a job. Going back a few years ago, when I was lab director at Orange County Sheriff, we had a position open for laboratory technician, and the only requirement was that you had basically finished or were working on finishing a bachelor's in a degree in a natural science. I had two positions open. I had 77 applicants, and all but two already had their master's degree competing for a position that didn't even require the college degree. So it gives you the level of commitment, I think, that people are bringing to the field. And lastly, I'd recommend some level of professional involvement, whether it's by volunteering time or doing an internship per se in a crime lab, much like I got a start in my career, or getting involved with professional organizations so that you're aware of what's going on a national level within the disciplines that you're interested in working. That will greatly benefit your ability to secure that dream job, you know, in forensic science.
Cool.
We've been hearing that Melendez-Diaz versus Massachusetts, which is a Supreme Court decision, that basically says the person who writes a lab report has to appear in court, or the defendant has a right to actually have that person present in court. Has that created any problems for you? Because I'm hearing from some labs that it takes people away from labs that are already overwhelmed to testify. Has it had any effect on you guys?
Jen, we've had some effect, but I wouldn't say that it's been a major effect. I know that there are agencies across this country that have had tremendous impact from this ruling, but for us, generally speaking, the author of the report, the individual who's signing the laboratory report, is almost always, in fact, I can't think of a circumstance where they're not, the primary examiner in the case. Now, there are situations, for example, in DNA, where because of time constraints and goals of trying to reach efficiency and productivity models, that we use a system called batching. And by way of description, in the traditional sense of forensic science, usually when someone gets a case, they open it up and they do the entire case. They do all the steps of the analysis from beginning to end, and it's done by that one person. In a situation where you're trying to look at efficiency models or using automation and other types of technology that helps us increase our throughput, what we do is we do work in teamwork-like fashion. So one person may take one phase of the test. Another person might then be handed the samples and they'll work on another phase, and then a third person might be involved, and then it comes back to the original examiner for reporting purposes. What we're finding is in some situations, particularly DNA, we have had to have, you know, more than just the reporting examiner, because there's been more than one person that's handled evidence or worked on evidence in that case. And that's ultimately what Melendez-Diaz is after. In Massachusetts, what they used to do was they used to have a reporting examiner who was different than the actual analyst. And then the reporting examiner wouldn't usually appear in court. They would sign a testimonial certification statement. And it prevented basically the cross-examination of an expert in court. And that's really what the Supreme Court ruled. We have traditionally gone to court. We go whether we're called by the prosecution or the defense, because ultimately the results we get are not of concern to us. We're speaking on behalf of the science and behalf of the evidence, not for a particular side. So we'll respond to whoever calls. But the effects have been seen, but they haven't really been major, thank goodness, for the LA Sheriff's Crime Lab.
Cool. You were, as Jen mentioned earlier, recently appointed to the National Commission on Forensic Science. What does that entail? And tell us what that organization is and what its mission is and what your role in it.
Sure. Well, let me take a step back, if I may, and just kind of set the stage for why the commission was formed. But back in 2009, Congress was issued or was given a report by the National Academy of Sciences, and that report is viewed upon as a major pivotal point in our field that addressed some concerns about forensic science delivery across the United States. There were some concerns and questions about qualifications of staff, training, education programs, the types of evidence and what we can say, whether an individual can be uniquely identified, if you will, based on fingerprints because of lack of what was perceived data statistically. And as a result of that report, there were a number of things that took place. The White House got involved, Congress got involved, and the United States Department of Justice, along with NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, also got involved. Well, this commission is actually a joint collaboration between the United States Department of Justice and NIST. And what they've done is created a commission. It's 30 commissioners that have been taken from a well-rounded area of criminal justice. So it's not just forensic scientists. It includes judges, attorneys, law enforcement, stakeholders, as well as forensic scientists. And the goal of the commission is really to improve the practice of forensic science. I think what you'll probably see, and I'm saying this in the future sense because we're meeting just really in a couple days for the first time. So we don't really have our marching orders yet, but they're coming. But likely be things like developing guidance concerning the intersection of forensic science and the criminal justice system. I'm sure it'll include things like policy recommendations for the Attorney General, perhaps even policy recommendations for funding entities like the National Institute of Justice. There'll be things dealing with professional involvement like accreditation and certification, accreditation being for laboratories, certification being for examiners. Do we need to create a national code of ethics, by way of example, in forensic science? Many professional organizations have a code of ethics, but there is not one national standard that people have to follow. So there are a number of things I think this commission is going to look at in moving forward. And some of them are going to be welcomed by the forensic community, and I think some of them are going to be frightening to the forensic community to implement, both in cost and time. But, when you look at the importance of what we do, I don't think we can take, the work we do lightly, and certainly anything we can do to standardize forensic science across the United States would be welcome.
I'm thinking that part of that standardization happens before things come to the lab. And we kind of talked about this a little, actually, earlier when we were talking about the sexual assault kits. I think this is part of all this, is I'm noticing that some of the labs that seem to have the fewest problems have also taken the time to do training with law enforcement. So in other words, with the people that are on the front line there at the crime scene from the start, and their actions can have such a huge impact on evidence and so on. So can you talk to, are you doing that kind of training at the Hertzberg-Davis Center, and what kinds of training have you been doing?
Well, we are, and in fact, not only are we heavily involved in the technical training, and luckily for us, we have not just the collaboration with LAPD, but the association with the California Department of Justice, because they have a teaching branch called the California Criminalistics Institute, called CCI. And CCI is effectively the teaching arm of forensic science for us, particularly in California, but I would say for many West Coast or Western region agencies in the United States. The National Academy at the FBI is viewed as a kind of the premier training facility for up-and-coming mid-level managers in law enforcement, and you can liken CCI to kind of like a National Academy perspective. People come to CCI because of the quality of training. Well, it's expensive to send people in locations, and I think one of the nice things we have in a facility like ours at the Hertzberg-Davis Forensic Science Center is, we can bring experts in. It allows us to keep our staff local, maximizing the use of our dollars. But it's not just technical training that's important. We're looking at other areas. There's an expert named E.T.L. Dror. He's out of the U.K., and he's bringing a huge awareness to forensic science in the United States about issues of bias. Do we know too much about certain cases? Does normal human biases and the way the mind operates and works from a biochemical and physical perspective, does it influence the way we do our work? That's his great area of study. You know, we brought him in to teach us. I have another individual, Dr. Scott Chappelle, who's going to be coming from Indiana, and what he's going to be talking about for us is issues of, you know, sleep deprivation and or circadian rhythm cycles, and whether or not the hours that people work during the time of the day or the number of hours they get at sleep, does it affect their human performance level in the workplace, and how do we mitigate those factors? He's a world-renowned expert in training military pilots, Navy SEALs, and special teams in sleep deprivation issues and helping them literally stay alive and keeping their edge. So we're looking at these kinds of things in addition to managerial things like what kinds of performance metrics and business operative kinds of opportunities can we take to enhance what we do so that we're spending public funds wisely. So there's really a huge and broad scope of training that's been made available to all of the staff that are in this facility.
That's great.
What can people out there in the community do to help support your lab? What kind of support can you get from the local community?
You know, I think the best thing we can do are things like this. It's more educational based, helping people understand what life is really like inside the crime lab, you know, dispelling some of these misconceptions, number one. I think number two is the issue that, you know, funding is important. And I don't want to sound too bureaucratic in this process, but, you know, we spend more money in the United States on research on whether or not cosmetics are allergenic or not than we do in the totality of forensic science. And I think, not to put the cosmetic industry down, but I would say if I were given the choice between the two, I think I'd rather see more dollars going toward, you know, putting people behind bars who should be held accountable for their crimes and freeing those who are wrongly accused of crimes than worrying about whether or not a particular cosmetic is viewed as allergenic or not. And, you know, it's not to say that we don't have enough and we need more. Everyone does. But, you know, the reality is when you look at forensic science, and, you know, one of the areas that we're working on now that we're over the sexual assault kit backlog is we're now doing DNA on property crimes. Well, imagine now if you can catch people much earlier in their criminal careers, put them into a custody facility where, although open for debate, you can rehabilitate them and return them as productive members of society instead of continuing on in the criminal destructive, you know, aspects of what they do. You wonder how much safer of a community we can live in if we had enough resources to do that. If we could change, you know, the community and the lives and the way that people who are committing these crimes can be released back into society.
Sure. What's on the horizon? What do you see for the future?
Well, interesting question. You know, I think this national commission is going to be a very interesting thing to watch. I think there's going to be some rapid technology change that's around the corner. We're seeing areas of DNA changing rapidly again with a couple of different things. One is called rapid DNA testing, the idea of being able to do a DNA test in 90 minutes in a black box that you can carry in a car or put in a police station. We're looking at next-generation sequencing, where you can conduct one simple DNA test and get every possible DNA result that you can get instead of doing multiple tests over multiple periods of time. I think the issue of the electronic age is going to change forensic science. It's going to be probably the next biggest and greatest area of concern. You're seeing focus put on a national level about data security. Just by way of example, look at, you know, the recent news with the issues, you know, at a major retailer, you know, having problems with data security issues. Well, what happens now when people are committing these, you know, large crimes, not just, you know, identity theft, but, I mean, major theft of information that's costing people millions and millions of dollars. You know, how do we investigate those crimes? How do we prove those crimes? And so the era of digital evidence and what we do and where we go is going to be revolutionary. I mean, I can do more on my cell phone today than I can ever do on the first computer I worked on. you know, and the power and information that's in there is amazing.
Oh, your cell phone has more computing power than NASA did when we walked on the moon. It's true.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it.
Well, Dean, you've been involved in professional organizations, forensic science professional organizations, and have really done a lot to work to improve forensic science in the U.S. I can see that as a member of this National Commission on Forensic Science, I really feel that we're in good hands having you there to represent you. Just want to thank you so much for spending time with us tonight and for all you do to make forensic science work better, not just here in the Los Angeles area, but nationally. So thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's really an honor to be in this profession, and it was a real pleasure to be with both of you here today. So thank you.
Really enjoyed it. Thanks.